Welcome to the Alcohol Rethink Podcast, the podcast for men who are ready to rethink the role of alcohol in their lives for good. With shared experiences, concepts, tools and coaching, get ready to radically change how you think about alcohol and stop drinking for good. I'm your host, Patrick Fox. Let's go. Hi guys, and welcome to episode number 142 of the Alcohol Rethink Podcast. Awesome to be back. Good to be with you and to share with you some more tools and experiences and interviews with how you can begin to rethink alcohol in your life. And today I'm thrilled to be joined by a very special guest. Her name is Jill Mackay. She is a professional coach, speaker and trainer with over 30 years experience and more recently a TEDx talk, which I highly recommend going and watching, called The Surprising Stigma of Sobriety. I'm super looking forward to this conversation because I've already connected with Jill and I know that she has a real love for the brain as well as sobriety. So I know you're going to have or love listening to her and learning from her. Hello, Jill. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Patrick. And 142. Congratulations. That's amazing. An amazing number.
Yeah, yeah. Keeps going up and up. I mean, gosh, I remember just the first 10 and how much trauma I put myself through trying to get them out into the world, and I'm just so grateful I've stuck with it, like many things, like sobriety, yeah. Of course, as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. Great.
Cool. Well, I'd love to hear a little bit more about you. I mean, I've given you a little introduction there, but
yeah, but
like maybe expand more on the brain element and we'll get into the sobriety afterwards.
Sure, yes. So the brain element's quite a funny story, actually. And I started my working life in the 1980s, and I was one of the late 80s, and not too aging. And I was one of these very fortunate people who, after university, I just found the role that I loved. I didn't know what I wanted to do. So I ended up in training and development in what is sort of rather horribly known as soft skills training, sort of working with people around leadership and personal development areas. And as I got promoted and worked through this, I was responsible for running the leadership school of a corporate university, which is it's a posh way of saying that I was in charge of leadership training for Europe. My opposite number, who ran the leadership school in North America, his uncle Bill was a neuroscientist.
Oh, right.
So this is how I got into it. And it was just at the time that neuroscience was becoming applicable to the world of psychology. So it was at the time where applications beyond just the clinical, so beyond the medical arena, were beginning to be applied, that, you know, we could recognize that we could get some real understanding of human behavior from experimentation around the brain, as well as those clinical settings to help people with neurodegenerative conditions. So it was a really exciting time. And what my opposite number Tim did in the States and myself is we looked at the theory and what was coming out of the various universities and centers of excellence around the world to see how we could bring neuroscience into the leadership arena that we were working in. It's a very sort of simplistic level. It was about helping people to become friends with their brain and to understand that they can make choices by really looking at brain health. And that's how it all started. And I became a bit of a neuroscience nerd and a bit of a geek since then.
Yeah, well, brilliant. I'd love to hear some of that geekiness on today's episode. And I think it's so important to become that friend with your brain, because I think a lot of the time we believe what our brain is telling us, and it can be very critical sometimes, and being able kind of dissociate from that and understand what's going on. And more recently, maybe not more recently, but there's lots and more studies about dopamine, right, and what's such a big role that plays in everything that we seem to do, especially when it comes to addictions like alcohol.
Very much so. And I actually, when I look back, I don't think that I consciously used the neuroscience in my own recovery, if you like, or my own decision to and an initial part of the journey. But certainly, of course, I was using my knowledge at almost a subconscious level. You know, I was looking after my brain, because the reality is that alcohol messes with our brain chemistry. You know, it messes with the receptors, the different neurotransmitters. I guess the big four would be the dopamine, as you say, serotonin, which is all about mood, acetylcholine, and another one I can't remember at the moment. You know, those are the ones that it's GABA. Those are the ones at the moment that I think are really important to balance. And when we drink, we don't have that natural balance. You know, we're almost looking for a balance, to feel balanced in the body subliminally by imbibing the alcohol. You know, people talk about, and rightly so, but it's a very simplistic level, we talk about the reward of the alcohol. But then what happens after the initial hit, and yes, that initial hit does raise our dopamine levels initially. It also translates into the body with changes in cortisol and adrenaline and all sorts of other stuff. But then alcohol will depress our nervous system. And I think that it's almost subliminally, subconsciously, I was using that knowledge when I quit the drink myself, when I went through my own journey, and using the knowledge of some of the neuroscience stuff, like very simplistically, you know, people talk about sports people, for instance, using visualization as a really important tool. And it is, it's a motivational tool. It's a driving tool, a drive forward tool. And part of the reason that that works, I mean, it's not a guarantee of a gold medal, but part of the reason that works is that the brain cannot tell the difference between what's real and what is imagined. So we can create pathways for a future that we're visualizing in all its glorious color and all those sensory inputs, then we can create something that can become more real for us when we're coming to doing it for real. So yeah, the brain is a very powerful thing, a very powerful.
It is. It's super powerful, and we've got to harness its power rather than let it do what it wants to do by default, because that's where we find ourselves in challenges and problems.
Exactly. I mean, the brain wants to keep us in familiarity. It is you know, it's a pattern matching machine, and it does that to keep us safe. You know, if we've been okay yesterday and we've used those familiar patterns, then why risk doing something different today? You know, when we feel butterflies in our stomach, you know, when we're getting out of our heads and into our body, it is our body giving us some sort of warning sign that something different is about to happen. So it's actually, you know, it's easy to keep in a habit. I don't want to say the opposite, that it's difficult to change a habit, because it isn't, with the right sort of strategies and small steps ahead of us. But we have to want to change the habits. You know, the brain will keep us in a pattern if it can at all do that, because patterns are safe. Yeah, but patterns are familiar.
Allegedly safe.
Indeed.
Allegedly
indeed.
Safe.
I certainly wasn't in a safe pattern for decades when I was drinking.
Yeah, it's kind of that expression, better the devil you know, right? Like, you know what to expect from it, even if you might not like it, but you still do it because you know what to expect.
Precisely so. And even if we know that there are consequences for something, you know, it's very interesting. And the whole confirmation bias piece comes in as well, where we look for evidence to really fuel our own story. And we find that evidence around us, you know. So I think part of my confirmation bias around my drinking was, and this comes into the whole thing about stigma, was that I'd look around and I'd look at other people and I'd think, oh, well, I'm not that bad. I'm only drinking wine. I'm not drinking vodka. You know, it's very, very interesting. And that kept me. It gave me permission to stay in my pattern of drinking. You know, oh, I am glad I am drinking, because otherwise I would be stressed. Knowing intellectually that the drink was fueling the stress, but giving myself permission through my confirmation bias to carry on drinking.
Yeah. Well, that's that lower brain's kind of primitive desire, right? And just all survival
primitive and
based.
Powerful desire. Yeah. And on that front, that the primitive brain is really interesting. There's all sorts of, the one wonderful thing about neuroscience is that as the experiments grow, as the research grows, and here we are in 2024, you know, it was in the 1990s, the late 90s, that Uncle Bill got Tim and I into the neuroscience in leadership. You know, we there's so much that is beginning to be both refuted, but I'll say that in a very positive sense. We're finding out more about the brain, the human brain, and how it operates. You know, so for instance, left brain, right brain theory, which really was a thing in the 1990s. You know, it to a degree, metaphorically, it is true, but there really isn't. It's wrong to say that the right brain is entirely responsible for creativity and you're making connections, and the left brain is entirely responsible for rules. You know, we use all of our brain all of the time, but you know, I still think that keeping. I'm just a bit of a geek and a nerd. I just love reading research
No,
around the brain
yeah, and
and
I
keeping.
love talking about it as well. So I'd like to, yeah, I think it'd be really cool if we just stay with this for like a few more moments, because I think people listening will be able to learn from it and recognize in themselves that, you know, a lot of what's happening is because of our brain. And when we understand that, we can remove that layer of stigma, shame, blame, etc. So a few things that came up for me, right? Like that one about fueling your own story and how we compare to the worst possible outcome, right? We go, oh, well, that's not me, so therefore I'm okay. I also notice it works the other way, right? Like when people are conscious that they want to stop drinking, they find themselves comparing themselves to people who are drinking and going, oh, it's all right for them. Why am I the only one who's going through this? Why can't I stop drinking, right? And when I hear it, I find it so fascinating because we really have got no idea what is going on in anybody else's lives. And I can guarantee that alcohol affects everyone in some way, shape, or form, right? But that's just the way the brain operates, and what it's looking for is that there's something wrong with you and not someone else, because they seem to be able to drink more or drink more often and not get hungover, whatever. So that all of those things, which is just absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I wonder whether the word comparisonitis has made its way into the Oxford English Dictionary yet, because it certainly will. It's a thing, isn't it? It's an Instagram thing, and you know, people talk about it. And I think it is one of the things that really pulls down people in with their confidence to try something new or take a new step or get out of the pattern or say to their brain, hey, be my friend for today. We're going to try something different. You know, that whole comparison piece, that whole, you know, sort of worry about how look at them, they're living that rainbow and unicorn life because and they've become alcohol free. I couldn't possibly do that. You know, the brain does also have a negative bias, and part of that again is to keep us safe, so that we, you know, the negative bias is to look at the consequence almost before the possibility. You know, and I think that perhaps when we're fueling our brain with drink, you know, maybe our possibilities become even more limited because we don't allow them to be real for us because we're not experiencing possibilities every day. Yeah, that's a mindset thing, and it's you know, it's not enough to read a couple of, you know, gorgeous affirmations and lovely motivating books to be able to think, so I'm going to be in a possibility today when you're drinking. You know, I think that, you know, when our
Because your
brains are
brain's
more.
driven by the possibility of drinking all the time, right?
Oh yeah, exactly. There you go. And it's all a big mess, isn't it? It's all. I like to say that life's like a big Venn diagram. If you go back to, you know, maths at school, you know, it is. There's nothing's really mutually exclusive. It's all a. But that's part of the richness and the joy of and curiosity of life, isn't it? Finding out what motivates us, what's crossing over with what, making connections, and coming to some sort of great conclusion for yourself. But I think that when we're drinking, we dilute. Sorry, that's a drinking term. But we dilute those possibilities and those connections. You know, we just numb them out, and therefore it's harder for us to see a possible future for us.
Yeah, it all just becomes a bit samey, samey. And I think that was my experience. You know, in the end, it was just so monotonous. I was just going through the motions with it. Like, I wasn't it. I was writing this the other day. It's like in the beginning, it starts out as fun. And then you depend on it to have fun. And then it's not very much fun at all, you know. And that's that journey, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think there's another step, isn't there? That when do you admit it to yourself that it's not fun anymore? When do you really admit it? Yeah, and maybe that's the point at which change can come.
100%. Just on that comparison thing, like it is really fascinating, because it can go off in so many different directions. Like you can compare to, say, that, oh, I'm not that drinker, so it's okay for me to drink. And then you can compare yourself to like, oh, it's okay for them to drink, but obviously there's something wrong with me, which there's not. But then also, yeah, comparing yourself to people who aren't drinking, go, oh, it must be easy for them because they're not drinking, right? And we use it against ourselves, certainly. I remember, this isn't drinking related, but it was just so fascinating to become aware of it. I was working on this project for a contracting role that I was doing, and I was finding it a little bit challenging. I was finding it tough. I was procrastinating on it, right? Like all of the things, judgment, self-judgment. And then someone walked past my window. I didn't know who they were. I'd never seen them before. And I heard this, right? My brain went, oh, it's all right for them. And I was like, what on earth are you talking about? Like this person who's walking outside, in my head, my brain made out that it was better for them to be out there than what I was experiencing in myself, which is probably an element of truth to it. But really, I had like zero idea of what was going on for them, right? It's just incredible what our brain gets up to if we're not aware of it.
Absolutely. And then we get in that pattern again, you know, which is a, you know, solid neuroscientific fact. You know, the more we do something, the easier it is to access those neural pathways. And we can get into a pattern of comparing, you know, without realizing it, in all sorts of different contexts and circumstances. So then comparison becomes part of our decision model, which then becomes, you know, like that can be quite dangerous in some ways, in some context, you know. And also it can be a driver for some people as well to compare. And it's it is interesting.
Maybe this is a whole other podcast I might create around this, right? But like we can use comparison in a way to support and lift us up rather than like keep us down, you know. One other thing as well, this conversation around our brain essentially wants to use the past to predict the future, right? Like because that's what it does, because that's what feels familiar, it feels safer, even as we've discussed, isn't. And I played football last night and I did a meditation before I played. And it was great because it was only 8 minutes long, but it just kind of got me centered and focused. And it was like a couple of little affirmations or mantras in there. And it was very different. I went and played and felt much calmer doing it. And I think, because like you're saying, it's like you're getting the mind to focus on a different outcome, focusing on what you want instead of what you think is going to happen, which often isn't what you want to happen.
Yeah, exactly. And also in the process of meditation, the very nature of the way that, you know, meditations tend to be set up, you are going through a whole process, your body is going through a whole process of grounding yourself. So you would have entered that football match in a far more calmer state, for want of a different word. You know, I think your mindset was different because you were listening to different words and you were visualizing and thinking about different things and getting yourself into the zone, whatever the language is that you use. But you're also grounding your body, and the whole essence around meditation. And you know, if you said this to me 8 years ago, I quit drinking 7 years ago, then I'd have rolled my eyes and thought, who are you talking, you know, to about meditation? But you know, the whole essence of meditation is around presence. It's around being in the moment. And when we are in the moment, we have the opportunity to be able to pause. And when we can pause, we have the opportunity to make a different choice. And I think that's very powerful for people who are drinking, you know, that whole picture of standing in front of the fridge for me, it was the cold bottle of Sauvignon Blanc. And, you know, if you are able, I'm not suggesting that we all stand in front of the fridge and meditate, but if we are able to learn some very basic meditation or grounding techniques, we are giving ourselves the gift of a pause. And what that then does is it really calms our brain and it calms our nervous system. And maybe within that calmer state, we're able to make a different decision.
Yeah, that's not just for drinking, is it? That's such a great life skill.
Well,
I have to remind myself of often with teenagers and young children. it's a great, like, there's that Viktor Frankl quote, isn't it? It's like between stimulus and response, there is a space. In that space is our ability to choose. In that space is freedom. I'm paraphrasing, but it's something along those lines. But it's really, really powerful. And you know, it's about finding those spaces.
Absolutely.
Practicing them before you need them. That's what I'm a big advocate of.
I couldn't agree with you more. And building the pattern of that space, I think that's a very empowering and very proactive thing to do. And I wonder whether drinkers fill the pause, because in the pause they might be have facing some form of reality, you know, and there's some shame, or it might pull up some different emotions. So, you know, I've certainly filled a lot of my pauses with glug 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 of Sauvignon Blanc in the day.
Yeah. I didn't even know I was filling pauses, right? Like it just was so automatic, just stimulus and response. I was like, okay, yeah, we're drinking again, or
Or it is 6 o'clock, it's time, you know, whatever it
yeah, all
is, you know,
those
it becomes
beliefs.
kind of hardwired, you know, that pattern, that trigger, call it what you will. Sort of, oh yeah, I'm closing my laptop, or oh, it's whatever time of day, or oh, I've finished work, or you know, for some people they drink in the day. You know, there's something that gives us permission, possibly by pattern, and therefore the word you use, automatically, that we'll just go and open the bottle.
Yeah. Well, this feels like a lovely little segue into your alcohol rethink journey. Where, what, how, yeah, tell us.
So it's really funny the way that people categorize markets. You know, right now I'm a sober coach and a sober mentor, and I work with midlife women. You know, so I am a midlife woman, or was a midlife woman who had a challenge around drinking. And to a degree, I think it was an absolute classic scenario. I was squashed in that midlife piece of teenage children that you've already mentioned, elderly parents, ill, you know, ailing elderly parents, business that was challenging in many ways. I was in a partnership business at the time in a company called My Brain International. So it was a neuroscience business with a business partner. And there were some challenges, but there were also some great things going on in that business. But there was a lot of stuff, you know, a lot of stress, a lot of perhaps I redefined the stress for myself. I very much felt like I was living my life in a washing machine, you know, and it was constantly, you know, going at full spin. And really, and I really hope to articulate this so that it doesn't come across as that there's any blame. There really, really isn't. It was a situation that we found ourselves in, that my mother-in-law moved in with us. My father-in-law died very suddenly, and my mother-in-law was disabled. And it was really, she was down in Devon, we live in London. It was really going to be a choice of either she went into a care home because she couldn't really look after herself, or she came to live with us. And it was me that pushed that. So despite the accent, I'm Scottish. And a lot of Scottish families have three generations in the house. It's just kind of, I guess, a societal thing. Probably over the years, it's come from some, you know, working class roots, etc. We had my granny living with us, so I was very used to that three generation thing. And as a child, it was an enormous joy having my grandmother in the home. So it was the right thing to do. We actually moved house to accommodate my mother-in-law. She was with us for 8 years, and it was the right thing to do, and I'd do it again in a heartbeat if it was to happen again. But Patrick, I'd do it with boundaries this time. You know, hindsight is a wonderful thing. I do it with stronger boundaries. And I think that experience heightened my drinking. At the same time, my daughter, my youngest daughter, so I've got three kids, a son and two daughters. My youngest was diagnosed with OCD that was really quite challenging. She's amazing now. She's 21 now. She'll always have OCD, whatever that means in her context. And she's able to manage that now at the age of 21. It kind of all came into this melee of stress and stuff, and you know, exams and university entrances and GCSEs and an ill dog and, you know, and two dogs, all this sort of stuff. So I drank more. My drinking escalated. I have always enjoyed a drink, and my drinking in my 20s, I was very much the proverbial party girl. And I can say right now that in my early 60s, I'm still a party girl, but I don't have any alcohol in the glass. You know, it's
Yeah,
really
good for
interesting.
you.
But absolutely, the
Yeah.
label we give ourselves is, again, if from a neuroscience perspective, it gives us permission to go do, you know, to go act, to go fulfill, you know. And so I said I was this party girl. I fulfilled my life with bubbles and wine through my 20s. So I've always enjoyed drinking, but it escalated in my 50s when, and my late 40s when we're looking after all of the parents and going off to different sides of the country to look after aging parents and had the kids. And Georgie was diagnosed with her OCD, and I just stuck myself into a bottle of Sauvignon Blanc. And I think what really happened to me, again, in our world, and if you, all the quit lit that's around, you know, the literature, the books talk about rock bottom moments.
Yeah.
And I didn't have a rock bottom moment, you know, one of the dreadful moments that some people have that is the wake up call. I had a series of little rock bottom moments that compounded. And I remember doing some geography revision with one of my kids for their GCSE, and we were talking about rivers, which reminded me really why I never really took up geography or was interested in doing geography beyond A levels in those days. And it was something around the riverbed and the erosion of the riverbed. And I remember, I'm quite metaphorical in the way my brain works, I'm very visual, and I remember helping one of my kids with this revision, testing them on it, and thinking that's what's happening to me with drinking. You know, that, you know, I've got literally lots of little pebbles, in, you know, running along the riverbed, bouncing along, you know, surviving, being okay, but eroding the riverbed, which was my life. So I was really eroding my life. And I think the big moment for me came when one day one of my mother-in-law's carers, so we had care coming into the house, lovely, lovely people. And again, even though it was something that I managed and I instigated, and what we needed for her to help with her care, I resented that it was did come into my kitchen and make Margaret a cup of tea. You know what they were going to do, and I kind of like, oh, for goodness sake, you know, they're in my kitchen, in my space. And one of the carers walked in when I was pouring wine. It must have been the last appointment of the day, which she, I think Margaret had a, it was 5 o'clock, was the last carer of the day. And they walked in around five, and I was pouring wine into my Gary Barlow mug. I do laugh about it now, but it was a pivotal moment because I was pouring wine into a mug.
A
I
mug,
mean, you know,
yeah.
really interesting. I mean, I laugh now because I'm a massive Take That fan, you know, that Gary Barlow was part of my journey to recovery, if you like. But in that moment, I felt such shame because Katie, and I remember her as a young girl who was doing caring. She was a trainee nurse as well, and she was earning a bit, trying to get a bit more money doing the caring. She was wonderful with my mother-in-law, and probably she'd have been 20, 21. So, you know, as my children's age, or my eldest age at that time. And I remember pouring the wine into the mug, and I felt she knew what I was doing. She didn't say anything. She just chatted as normal. And I kind of thought afterwards, as if people don't know that I'm drinking wine just because it's in a mug. I mean, you can
Is
smell
that
it.
was that the
You
intent then to conceal that you were drinking?
Do you know, consciously, I never had that conversation with myself. You
Yeah.
know, isn't that interesting? You know, never, but yes, it absolutely would have been. Now I know it was to conceal that I was pouring wine into a mug. You know, there was all sorts of secretive behavior. And the reality was that was a big moment. I didn't like myself. And that, so it was that dissonance. I needed to really feel that dissonance, that misalignment, that incongruence. And so when just going back a little bit, but please talk to me because I am very, very good at rambling. I've got a
No, you're
neural
good.
pathway for rambling, Patrick. So please
I
do stop me.
was thinking just
Yeah.
on that point, though, you know, there's a lot of talk about rock bottoms in the sober
Yes.
world, right? And I did a whole podcast on this. I said, choose your rock bottom, right? Like, you don't have to wait for things. You don't have to wait for shit to hit the fan, essentially, right? Like,
Exactly.
there's a moment, there's a point in everyone's journey where enough is enough. And it sounds like for you, someone seeing you pouring wine into a coffee mug, tea mug, whatever it may have been, right? Like, that was like your sliding doors moment. You kind of you were brought to consciousness of like, what the fuck am I doing, basically?
Precisely so. Precisely so. And you know, really? You know, a professional woman, you know, who talks about the brain and stands on stages in Asia, you know, gets paid for talking to people about human behavior,
Yeah.
pouring Sauvignon Blanc into a mug at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, really, and getting caught in the act. That, without a shadow of doubt, was my moment. And it was a moment of, I wouldn't say, sometimes I look at it and think, I wonder why I procrastinate. I don't think that's the right word. That same day, I told my husband, we had the conversation around, he was eggshelling around me, stepping on eggshells, and, are you aware that every time I talk to you about your drinking, you snap my head off type of thing? And I don't know where this came from. I honestly don't know. But I said to him, I need a fortnight. Time scale of 2 weeks came from, and I sort of said, that time,
Inner
I
wisdom.
want to, yes, and let's trust it, let's be good with it, because it, I
Yeah.
actually eat it if we're going to use it as a target, and what I said to him was, I need a fortnight, and in that fortnight I'm going to read everything I can. I'm going to research. That was my bent. I'm a big researcher. I really am. I'm a massive grabber of information, learning. And I said, I really want to be able to find out all of the different ways that I can use my own knowledge and use myself, harness it all to help me be successful and just do it one time. Because that was, I had never tried to stop before. I had tried to moderate. And it's interesting, I kind of had thought I'd tried to stop, but now I look back, no, I tried to moderate. I haven't had any, a sort of multitude of day ones, if that makes sense, because I haven't gone on the stopping. I've done the dry Januaries, I've done the sober Octobers, and one of my shameful dry, well, not shameful, one of my dry Januaries, I'll say it just, as it comes out, was staying up till midnight until February the 1st came, and then having a bottle of wine. I mean, hello,
Yeah, well, I talk about that. If you're taking a break, but at the same time you're excited about drinking again, then you're not achieving anything.
exactly. So, yeah, it's interesting. So I gave myself this fortnight, and I did exactly as I'd said. I read, I devoured. Not 7 years ago that there was much around. There was Annie Grace and William Porter. He just, I think, published his first Alcohol
Oh,
Explained
brilliant.
book. Yeah, Jason Vail, the juice guy, he'd also
Yeah,
done
yeah.
something around. Do you remember? He'd done something around
Yeah, I did a week
alcohol.
of
So,
juicing.
yeah, I bought a juicer during that fortnight. So there wasn't, now there's a plethora of the of literature and books and memoirs and all sorts of great stuff around. But yeah, there's some stuff on YouTube, and there was quite a lot from a neuroscience perspective. And I looked at 12 steps, I looked at all sorts of stuff. I had a prior to me quitting, I'd thought about 12 steps, not Alcoholics Anonymous, not in terms of myself, but in terms of a friend who was a great inspiration to me, who's 13 years sober. And she believes Alcoholic Anonymous has saved her life. She still goes to meetings every week, and she's absolutely part of this whole process. And it was really interesting. I sort of was very interested in the whole sort of pattern, the modus operandi of AA, and intuitively I felt it wasn't right for me. I approached it from an angle of neuroscience, that the whole perspective of saying, "Hello, my name is Jill Mackay and I'm an alcoholic," is giving a message to your brain at an identity level that this is what you
Yes.
are. It doesn't inspire change, and I really want to say absolutely out and loud, clear here, I am not disrespecting Alcoholics Anonymous to save lives. Absolutely. But I felt for me, it was the wrong thing. I wanted to find another path. And I think, had there been sober coaches available, and I was aware of them, I likely would have sought some help, because I'm a real advocate of coaching. I'm a real, I'm not afraid. I never have been afraid to ask for help. But I didn't know that sober coaches existed in
Yeah.
those days. I didn't, and then again, there's an abundance of people who've qualified, hopefully qualified, in this arena.
Yeah.
So
So what were your tools then? You had your moment of awakening, let's say.
So my tools were my research, my reading, my journaling, to very honest journaling. I've still got those books. I've got piles and piles and piles. My gratitude. Yeah, so really starting sincere gratitude journals. So let me just qualify that. Prior, when I was drinking and I was talking about from a neuroscience point of view about, how amazing gratitude is for well-being and all of that, just playing at it. I wasn't grounding, meditating, doing the thing. I think one of the greatest things for me, the tools in the very, very early days, was getting outside. And then
Yeah.
a tool slightly later on, sort of with probably after the first month or so, was writing. So I became, I was about to say, I became a, I'll tell you the story about the cliche. Yeah, my tools, my longer term tools were running and writing. And the reason I called that a cliche was I, and a big tool for me was the Soberistas website. So Soberistas is run by Lucy Rocker. And again, there were very few podcasts around in those days. You know, we didn't have the amazing choice of information and support that's around. But Soberistas has been going for 10 years now, and that was just amazing. It's a website with there's somebody globally on there all the time, writing, available to chat, and
Oh, wow.
it was just amazing.
Yeah.
But I found I, when I went to a when I was newly sober. I went to a Soberistas meetup where Lucy's based in Manchester. And I remember this lady in the audience who they were sober curious. In fact, I think she was really in quite a lot of pain, God bless her, this lady, but really wanting to find out what the magic trick, you know, what the magic formula was to sobriety. And I remember her saying, "Look, I'm not going to write a book and I'm not going to start running. So don't put me in that cliche box."
Yeah.
And it's really sat with me that, you know, I went, you know, at the age of 55 or 54, I joined the Ealing Eagles running club, my local running club, and they became my sober friends. Now, they weren't necessarily sober, but they became my daytime friends. And so I met a
Sure.
whole new friendship group. We'd go for coffee and cake after running. So we ran 5K together, we ran 10K together, and then we ran a half marathon together. I'm never doing that again. But that was fantastic. And my writing. So I wrote a book, and it was my neuroscience book, which is called Stuck. And I didn't write it. I wrote it, of course, for my market and because I was training coaches in neuroscience at the time. And so I wrote it for coaches. The real purpose of it, Patrick, was that at 5 o'clock every day, I no longer got a mug out of the cupboard to put a Sauvignon Blanc in. I went to a different room with a mug of tea, and I wrote. So, cliche or no cliche, the real tools, the ongoing tools that helped me was being outside and running, training, and that was a very new thing for me. And writing, they saved me without a shadow of doubt. And I discovered so much about myself in that whole process of writing. You know, I discovered, you know, I did have an introvert nature. You know, I just channeled my inner introvert. I liked my own company. I needed my own company. I discovered I loved writing. I discovered I was okay at writing. You know, I enjoyed it. And for the sheer mindfulness of the activity of writing, I discovered that I loved being outside in nature. I discovered that I didn't need to listen to music when I was jogging. I discovered all sorts of sensory awareness that I probably ought, well, of course, I always had it, but I'd either numbed it down or dumbed it down or diluted it or just didn't notice what was going on
Yeah.
around me.
Yeah.
So, and you know, that's familiar to many people, isn't it? They have this discovery of what's available to them every day.
Yeah. It's easier to adapt than change. You know, it's one of those mantras I like to sing. And we stop seeing what's in front of us. And I
Absolutely.
think when you're drinking alcohol, like you stop seeing a lot of things that are in front of you, and you stop
Yeah.
hearing and listening and like all of that
Yeah.
stuff. I love
Yeah.
what you were saying there about discovery, because that was something I saw on your website and I wanted to talk to you about actually, is that it your kind of your mantra is discovery, not recovery.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's beautiful because I think it is about self-discovery. I think that's one of the things guys I work with are most surprised about, is they think they're coming here to stop drinking, but actually they're coming to learn about themselves and learn. They learn why they're not drinking as part of that process, but they also learn about what led them to drink, you know, because what are the things, the decisions that they may be avoiding, or things that have been going on in their life that they weren't willing to look at. And it's that journey of self-discovery about who they want to be and what they want to do and where they want to go.
Yeah, I love what you say there. And I think that the way you articulated that and the language you use is also incredibly positive. And it's like the word I used before about possibility. And yet you'll know as a mentor and a guide and a coach as well, that that's really scary for people. it to discover who am I alcohol free is often a question that stops people or becomes another excuse or gives permission for people to stay drinking.
Yeah.
It's
Like we
the
said
other
earlier on,
addiction.
right? The brain's got nothing to compare it to because you've just been living more likely than not, majority of your adult life drinking alcohol, right?
Absolutely. And it
Got
was
nothing else
decades
to
in my
think.
case.
Yeah, exactly.
It's really interesting. For me, I think part of my discovery was, and I hadn't put words around it, not because I was pushing the words down, but I didn't realize was that I'd been living in absolute misalignment with myself for decades. And I think that wasn't the moment. The moment was the Katie coming into the kitchen and the Gary Barlow mug, and the geography revision and the gradual erosion. Those were my moments. But I was divorced when I was 30. I was married when I was 28 to a guy who was a serial philanderer. And as many women in these situations know, I thought I was the one who could change him. And he'd been married before to a lady. He'd split from her, and but she came from a different country. And he'd said to me, "I want to marry you. However, can we wait until she can get citizenship?" And I was like, "Yeah, absolutely." The irony of this is that I got on incredibly well with her. She was an absolutely delightful woman. And then, we got married, and yada yada yada. Before I knew it, I found out about the affairs. I think amplified for me by the fact that it was with my best friend. Really, really challenging. That escalated my drinking as well in my late 20s, early 30s. The reason I mentioned this is I remember coming out of that situation and there was no dubiety about it. And we were trying for a family at the time. I've always wanted to be a mother, but I did not want to live a dishonest life. And I'm very lucky. I had a lovely family around me and a lot of friends, but it was really, really important to me, this whole value of honesty. I felt the betrayal so hard, and the dishonesty of what was the way that they were living their lives. And it actually really made me realize how important honesty was to me. And then let's fast forward through the decades. And what has happened with me is that the drinking, I became secretive. I lied about some things to my husband, to my family, certainly lied to myself. This was more than denial. I think it was that incongruence, that erosion of myself was the dissonance and the incongruence with what was a really, really core value of mine about living an honest life. That was the thing that really got to me in the end. But
Yeah.
I was beginning to attach words to myself that I didn't like. I was really quite disgusted with the lying and the secrets and that behavior. And thank you, Gary Barlow mug and Katie coming into the kitchen for the moment and the catalyst. But there'd been this erosion of honesty throughout the decade. So it's that for me, it was misalignment, the dissonance, that incongruence that really very slowly helped me to get there. I think, we know intellectually that when people live in a misaligned way to their values, they're not living to their fullness, and that they
Yeah.
are that they shrink.
Yeah. I mean, that's the first thing I do with every guy that I work with is we do a values exercise and we dive deep into it. It's quite a challenging exercise to go through because they have to think, they have to get their brains to do a lot of work. We go beyond the surface level stuff and it really is huge, right? Because when you can
It
start,
is.
when firstly you've got to know what you value, right? And I think values change over time, of course, right? Like things change. And so we've got to know what you value, and then you can start going, okay, so it's no wonder I feel the way I do because I'm so far away from where I want to be or where I what I truly value in life. And so yeah, it's kind of like bringing those two back together and deciding what you want to do with it, how you can start living in alignment with it
Yeah,
then.
and again, I think even those words, the values, and there's so many things that come for me out of what you've just said there, about around sobriety isn't about the drink, really. It's so much more about what comes underneath and
It's literally
doing
just the
the
start,
work. Yeah, exactly. It's
right?
doing the work. And even the word values or doing a values exercise for some people feels really scary because it's kind of like meeting themselves for the first time, or meeting the person that they thought they were, re-meeting them, and that within that there's stuff comes up, inevitably. So we've got to go gently with that, but it's so worth it.
Oh, well, especially if you've never even looked at it before. I like
Yeah.
when I started getting into coaching and worked with some of my first coaches, a couple of things came up. Like one was my first one of my very first coach I worked with asked me what my strengths were.
Yeah.
I couldn't answer the question. Like I came out with a few things, but and I felt super embarrassed that I wasn't even able to tell somebody else what my strengths were, right? Like
Yeah.
that's how low my self-esteem had
Yeah.
become and how little I thought of myself. Except
Yeah.
the irony is I thought I was a really good drinker, right? So I had that to rely on. And then
Wow.
when I did the values exercise for the first time, like I've done it before and you just had to circle values, right? Like that's really easy. This doesn't require a great deal of thinking. But the way I do that values exercise is I get you to tell me what your values are. Like I don't give you any prompts. And that requires a lot more intentionality. And again, like I remember doing that exercise with my coach, and it was hard, you know. Like they and the beauty of it is that there's like this point, right? Like you get to about 10 values, which are easy because, well, maybe not easy, but like they come up. They're just like ones that we maybe a little bit generic or very obvious to you. But then we go through and we do like another 20. And there's like this little point with like I can't think of any more, and then all of a sudden like we get to 25, and then there's just like this stream of consciousness in terms of what's important to people, and that's where we really get to see like stuff that you aren't very aware of but is very important to you. So that's a fantastic exercise that I think anyone
And I
can
think
get
it's an
into.
essential exercise as well, provided it's facilitated and led, in the correct way, or in a really gentle, possibility oriented way as well, curious way as well. That reminds me, interestingly, Patrick, it's something I've never really forgotten. In years ago, when I was in learning and development, and I went through a facilitation skills course, and it is relevant to what you say. I remember the trainer saying to us, just stay a little bit longer at the flip chart. When the group thinks that they have run out of ideas, there'll always be another. Just pause. And it's the same in coaching. It is. And it's the same with ourselves. Again, back to that power of the pause. If we're patient, if we trust, we can find another option. It doesn't have to be an answer. I'm a great believer in broadening out rather than narrowing down. Of course, we need to narrow down to decisions sometimes, but let's keep ourselves working in the broadening out phase, where we can bounce and not evaluate. We can bounce ideas around that can, and go off at tangents, because it's in the tangents that sometimes the richness comes out.
That willing to experiment as well.
Yeah.
Willing,
It's
and sobriety
interesting.
does require a great deal of willingness. A willingness to be
Yes.
wrong about yourself, a willingness to try new things, you know. It's huge.
It
Jill,
is huge. Yeah.
what an awesome conversation. Time has absolutely whizzed by, unfortunately. I feel like we could go on for another hour, no doubt. What I'd love, oh, two questions before we kind of wrap up for this episode is, firstly, is there anything that you want to offer or share anybody listening who's on their rethink journey at the moment?
I think, well, a couple of things, really. I mean, one's a slight plug, but we'll start with the other. I think it really matters to really think about your why. I know a lot of people talk about this, but I think it matters, because if you know why you're wanting to do something, what you're working towards, then it keeps in mind that positive motivation. It helps you motivate. But also, don't set yourself stupid goals. Don't set yourself, when I say stupid, I say don't set yourself unachievable goals. Keep them small and simple, because there's magic in compounding. Just do one thing different every day, or something tomorrow that worked today. And know, we'll come back to the brain, know that third day, fourth day, fifth day, sixth day, and beyond, the more you repeat something that's working, that's new, that you're curious about, the more that it'll embed and become easier as you move forward. So I think your why it's worthwhile doing that work. Why do I want to become sober? Or why do I want to reset my life? Why do I want to have a go and experiment with something new? That's really, really useful. And I think that, also bear in mind that we can be motivated towards something and we can also be motivated away from something. So it's like the person who wants to lose weight or drop weight, I don't like using the word lose, but wants to drop weight. Do they keep a pair of larger jeans, whatever their size was that they're moving away from, and remind themselves, oh, I'm never going to be that size again? Or do they keep the aspirational little black dress that they want to get into? So what is your why? Where are you wanting to move towards? Also, remind yourself when you are, say, on day one, day two, day three, day four, you can look back and say, I was there, but I'm not there anymore. And there's pride in that. It really matters to grab that pride. And I think the other thing I would like to say is if I'm really okay talking about difficult subjects. So when I did my TED talk, I wanted to talk about shame and stigma. So the other thing I would say is, if you want to take a look at that, because I have had a few people coming to me to say that they feel less alone having heard someone talk about shame. I think we need to start to open up these conversations with each other. Not that it'll automatically, it's not a magic formula that things will feel less shameful, but I think if we start to have conversations, then they'll become more palatable and we can ask for help more easily.
You're allowed to talk about how you feel and how about how alcohol is affecting you without,
We are.
well, hopefully without that fear of judgment. Amazing. And a question I ask all of my guests is, what does it mean to be radically human for you?
Radically human means radically present. And it has so many, I used the word tangent before, and possibilities. I think if you're radically present, then you're present for yourself and you're present for everyone else. Ultimately, it's about connection. Radically human is about human connection. And I'll just leave it there.
Yeah, no, that's beautiful. Love it. And that presence is where the space is that we were talking about earlier on, right? And that's where you find the spaces in the presence.
And I didn't have allow myself that space when I was drinking.
Well, you
I was scared
can't.
of the space.
I mean, not that you can't, obviously you can, but it's challenging, right? Because when you taking a drug at the end of the day, like it moves you away from presence.
Yeah, it does.
Wicked. All right. What an amazing conversation. I've thoroughly
Thank you.
loved it. I would like for you to share with anyone listening where they can find out about you. Where do they need to go to get in touch?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you for the opportunity. So I mentioned my TED talk. I think you can find that on my website, so jillmckay.com. It's easy. I decided to stay with my name, so there. I hang out most on LinkedIn as well, so I'd love you to connect on LinkedIn for the individual, but also for the workplace as well. Again, I think we need to open up the drinking conversation at work. And realize that a team building event does not need to involve a night on the tiles.
No, that's
It's
good. And
not
I do.
inclusive.
Yeah, and I hear from people that that is changing, right? Like
Yeah, I
people
think
are
it is.
not just accepting that you go for drinks after work or things have to be alcohol related, which is fantastic, because
Isn't
when I
it
used to work
just?
in the city, that was not the case. It was very bad.
Yeah, no, but certainly wasn't the case for me when I started work in the late 80s.
No, I'm sure. Yeah, and everything else went on then. All right, amazing. Well, Jill, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate your wisdom and your journey, because I think, and your knowledge around the brain as well, because I think I just love it. I just think it's so amazing, because when we can recognize that, your relationship to alcohol isn't a you problem, right? It's nothing to do with your enoughness or worthiness or abilities, right? Like it's just how your brain is operating and how alcohol operates with your brain. Yes, you still have a choice in all of this, right? But I think once you start become aware of where the choices are, as we've discussed in this interview, that's where you can start creating space to make different ones for yourself.
I agree wholeheartedly, and thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, pleasure. All right, thank you for listening, everyone. Take care, and I'll see you again soon. Bye-bye. Stopping drinking can feel lonely. It doesn't have to be. If you're looking for accountability, motivation, and the tools to stop drinking, I can help you. Simply book a free consult with me today, and I'll show you how. Link in the show notes. See you again soon. Bye for now.